Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
A few years back, programmability became the big hype, and then automation. And everyone is doing this in unicorn-style environments. First huge data centers, then smaller data centers, then smaller data centers. And no one is talking about the underdog of networking, campus.
That's right.
Well, that's changing. With me today is Jack McLaughlin. Did I get the surname right?
You got that right. Very good.
Thank you. And we are at Cisco Live, and the guy who brought me here is also here, Tom Hollingsworth from Techfield Day. So, Tom, thanks for dragging me into Berlin.
Thanks for agreeing to be dragged to Berlin.
And Jeff had an interesting session today about NetConf on Catalyst switches. And, of course, we have to discuss that in more detail. So, Jeff, what's this thing all about? Why should anyone care about NetConf on Catalyst switches?
Well, you had a really good point. I actually started on the Nexus side. And so a lot of the programmability and automation technology started in the data center because, as you know, people were doing it before on the server side, right? So that's why we started to do Ansible and Puppet on Nexus switches. But on the campus side, people face a lot of the same problems, right? Which is just, you know, how do I configure a lot of devices efficiently? You know, how do I do things transactionally or programmatically? And so many of the same problems that you face in the data center, you face on the campus side. So it's logical that we need to start talking about programmability in the campus. So specifically what you're asking about is NetConf, which is for us on the Catalyst side, we just released it in 16.3, which is a fairly, it's been out for a little while. You know, it's certainly not the only thing that we're talking about. We can use Ansible, which I know you've done a lot of blogging on. We can use that to automate campus switches as well. Someday, you know, Puppet and Chef potentially, but that's not there yet on the Catalyst. But NetConf is out. And so I don't know if you'd like to start with an overview of NetConf or you want to know more about the reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that you've already posted a lot on your blog about, you know, Yang data models and what those are. And I know you had a podcast on OpenConfig just the other day.
So, okay, so let's start with an SD1. Why NetConf? Why not REST API?
Well, that's a very good question. So a couple of things about it. First of all, you can still use REST APIs if you want to configure your campus network. If you have something like APIC-EM, one of our products, right? We can manage our devices from APIC-EM, and then you could use REST APIs to talk to that. So it is still available. There's another protocol called RESTConf, which is essentially doing NetConf using REST-type APIs. That's not available yet, but it's being worked on, so we will have that option as well. Why NetConf instead of REST APIs? I think a lot of it comes down to the data models and the ability to describe the configuration and operational data on the switch. We use Yang models in NetConf, as you know, as well as RESTConf. So I think it comes down to that and just making it easier to manage the device.
So what you're saying is REST API, and I totally agree with you, as such, doesn't give you any information about what can be configured on the device.
Yes.
You are more or less on your own, and you guess your way around, or you read the documentation, whatever.
Correct.
But if you use something like NetConf, there's always a data model attached to it.
Yes.
So you can navigate through that data model and figure out what can be configured on the switch.
Correct. Or read from the switch as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I like to emphasize is the importance of operational data, reading data from the switch, which in the past we did, of course, using screen scraping and regular expressions. Some people love
so much fun.
Some people love regular expressions. I hate regular expressions. I'm a network engineer.
Have you ever met someone who loves regular expressions?
Oh, yeah. They're usually Unix sysadmin type guys or programmers who are very enthusiastic. I don't know, Tom, if you are. You're kind of nodding. But most network engineers are not. And as they're getting their feet wet in programmability, which is new, let's admit, for a lot of network engineers, I did not come from a software engineering background like most of us. The nice thing about having a clearly defined data model that's structured somewhat similarly to what you would see on the CLI of the device, which is what we all know and love, the big advantage of...
Do we love it?
We love CLI. We're network engineers.
Okay.
You don't love CLI?
No.
Oh. Well, but you're very advanced.
It's useful, but... Yeah. I don't have to love it because it's useful.
All right. Well, we all know it. Let's say that, at least. We all certainly know it. So if you're getting operational data out of a switch or a router, I work on switches, but of course, you know, we're implementing this on the routing side as well. It's much easier to work with. I mean, you get XML data back. You can very easily convert that, say, to a Python dictionary and tease out the piece of information that you want. Whereas before, you were doing regular expressions. So it's very important for operational data, but also for config data as well.
Okay, now that you mentioned the operational data.
Yeah.
I had this huge problem with Cisco IOS in particular, because it was impossible to get any XML structured data out of an IOS box prior to 16 dot something release.
Right.
Nexus OS was a different story.
Yes.
It was always able to render in XML or JSON.
Right.
And iOS was always printouts and screen.
Yes.
So what changed in iOS now? How can you give me operational data in XML format all of a sudden?
Yeah, yeah. So first of all, I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about iOS right now, but iOS XE, which is, you know, some different
same thing running on Linux.
So... under the hood, the way it works is we're using a TLF product, Conf-D, because TLF was a company that we acquired. So that's what's actually doing the processing of the data models. But the honest answer to that, not that that was a dishonest answer, but the real answer to it is that a huge amount of engineering effort went into developing the models and writing them and getting all the features on iOS devices modeled. And that's kind of a brute force effort. Mm-hmm. And it's still ongoing. We don't have 100% coverage. Now, as you know, Cisco is famous for having a lot of features on our boxes, a lot that, you know, people say, oh, we only use 10% of your features. But you look
everyone
at...
everyone uses a different
10%. Different 10%, as you know. So there is, again, a lot of effort that has to go into developing the models for all these features. Obviously, we take the priority features and most commonly used ones first, you know, so... you'll be able to do OSPF or BGP very quickly, but if you're using some obscure feature, it may take a little while longer. So that's the answer. It was a combination of infrastructure and just the engineering effort to develop the models.
But are you doing screen scraping behind the scenes, or are you actually extracting the variables from the memory, or are you doing SNMP MIP to... Yang data model translation.
Yeah, so you want to know under the hood about Conf-D, and so a couple of things. Conf-D does take the data model and convert it to CLI for config. Mm-hmm. So it does do that. To the NetConf user, it's the same, right? It doesn't really matter how it does it under the hood. Operational data, we're not doing screen scraping. Okay, so we actually have native models for the operational data that we read, because otherwise you'd have to, you know, develop some complicated regular expression for every operational command on the device.
I know.
Not going to happen. So we do have the ability for operational data. Now, you mentioned SNMP. If you download 16.3, the early implementation, that's the first release where we had NetConf, you will see some data models that are quite literally SNMP MIBs turned into NetConf operational data models. Those are like the first operational models that we had. But even in 16.3.2, which is the latest 16.3 release, you'll see a bunch of Cisco operational data models. So, you know, the SNMP ones are there. If you really liked the MIB structure and you're familiar with it, you could do it that way. But that's not the long-term plan.
So for people who love their MIBs, they can walk the MIBs now in XML.
Exactly.
For everyone else, there are the Cisco native data models, which are really... extracted from the operational data. It's not like three layers of screen scraping abstraction involved.
Right. And an important point that you mentioned there that I just want to tie into your podcast last week, there are the Cisco models, but we also support IETF models, and we're working on OpenConfig. So we're...
you guessed my next question.
Well, that's good. I'll try to guess your next one after that.
Okay, so what's the next one?
Well, let me finish with the first one. because I didn't finish it. So, yeah, I mean, we're very committed to the open models. I mean, I don't think I need to go into details about IETF versus OpenConfig. You had a long podcast about that earlier. Right now, if you get 16.3, you'll see the IETF models there. But, you know, we're working on the OpenConfig, and we're committed to it. So
which IETF models do you support today?
Off the top of my head, I don't know all of them. There's IETF interfaces, of course. 16.3 has just a few. 16.5, which is going to be released very soon, will have quite a few more. I don't know the list off the top of my head. You know, again, it's new. It's taking us time to get some of those models implemented.
Yeah, but they are all on GitHub, I think, right?
Yeah.
So I'll just insert a link into the show notes pointing to that GitHub repo and people can pull that up.
I wish someone had given me that before.
Yeah, exactly. So is anyone using this?
It is, like I said, very new. I mean, it's just out in 16.3. So we have a lot of interest from customers. A lot of customers are testing it in terms of production deployments. I don't know of any right now off the top of my head, but I mean, you know, we hear a lot of demand for NetConf and RESTConf and OpenConfig models. So, I mean, there's a lot of interest in it right now.
Service provider or enterprise community?
Well, mostly I'm dealing with enterprise community, but, you know, there are service providers that use Catalyst switches. It's certainly interesting.
So now that we covered the deep details, let's go back to where we should have started.
Yes.
What would be the use cases for this? Why would anyone want to do this?
You know, I go through a few use cases in my, you mentioned my session today and in my breakout in a few days. And let me back up even further, because I think when people talk about this, particularly with network engineers, they usually approach it from the wrong angle. They're often saying, well, you know, look at Facebook. They manage, you know, all these devices with just a few network engineers, and network engineers hear that and it kind of makes them nervous, right? Like,
oh, I lose my job.
Exactly. And so I, as a network engineer, again, I don't have a software engineering background. I look at it from a different perspective. For me, it's more about how do I alleviate some of the tedious and difficult aspects of my job and automate them so that I don't have to worry about them. So the example I always give is I think even today, even though people have been reading your blog and listening to your podcasts, most network engineers, if they have to configure something on a lot of devices, configure one and then paste it in a notepad and change a few things and paste it in the next one and paste it in the next one.
And that works so well, yeah.
It works so well. And, you know, it's interesting. People say CLI is error prone. You hear that a lot. And a lot of us say, well, we've been using CLI for years to manage very large scale networks, so, you know, how error prone is it? Well, you know, if you have to do a large config on hundreds of devices that way, you're going to make a mistake eventually. So the first big use case is very simply replicating a lot of config to a lot of devices and doing it easily, right? You can write a script that does that, you know, using expect or something like that.
Yeah, we all do that.
We've all done
our life.
But using a tool like NetConf with Python or even Ansible CLI templating, which is a great way to start for people who don't want to learn Python, it simply makes it a lot easier to do those kinds of large changes. Some of the other benefits that I like to talk about, transactionality. I mean, NetConf has the capability to roll back on error. So we all know that if we paste a big block of config and there's one line wrong, all the rest of the config goes in, but that one line doesn't. You may not want all of that extra config committed if that one line fails. NetConf can really easily roll back on error. And I think, you know, we have some other use case, particularly, we don't have it just yet, but we will have on-box Python capability. And you can even do NetConf using the on-box Python, or you could also send CLI commands if you want. So we can do things like, you know, react to conditions on the device and take certain actions based on, you know, process hitting a certain level on your CPU or a certain number of errors on an interface counter. Those are the kinds of things that are hard to do without automation. So those are a few of the use cases. It's one of those tools that I think if you start playing with it and learning the capabilities, you'll find use cases yourself. Long answer to short question.
No, it's a perfect one. So on the configuration side, obviously making uniform configurations, pushing out changes to all the boxes at the same time to make the configuration consistent. Maybe you can start thinking about deploying services and service modeling and things like that. What about on the operational data side? What would you collect there, and why would you use NetConf or whatever else instead of, let's say, SNMP?
Particularly when you start looking at writing scripts. I think that's where the benefits of using NetConf and Yang models show up over SNMP particularly. Because if you looked at an SNMP MIB, you know, the structure of the ASN.1 notation is kind of confusing and hard to use. Whereas if you're doing a script, you can, again, bring things into Python dictionaries very easily, etc. In terms of, let's see, your other question was operational data and what we can do with it?
Yeah. What would be some of the cool things you could do now that you have structured operational data?
Right. Cool things. I'm trying to think of a specific use case. You know, I think the most important thing, again, is just the ability to use the buzzword programmatic, just the ability to take actions based on conditions on the device. So, for example, I'm trying to think of a good example, and I'm drawing a blank right now. This is what happens when you're in the podcast. But
that always happens, don't
worry. Yeah, yeah. You know, I think, but the point I was trying to make is, you know, you can, you know, query the routing table, and if a route is missing, take a particular action. The example that I was thinking of has come to my mind. One of the things that I think a lot of us do, this is kind of, I talked about the tedium of repetitive configuration, but there's a tedium of repetitive operational actions. So let's say user A cannot communicate with user B. Typically, we're going to go to the first hop switch, maybe, you know, look at the route.
Well, first you have to figure out where the user is connected to.
Absolutely.
He can only give you his phone number.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm kind of shortening it. But eventually you're probably going to do a series of steps that you've done hundreds, thousands of times in your career. Maybe show IP route, or maybe ping from a router switch, then do a show IP route. Then you see the route's missing. Okay. Then we maybe do show IP OSPF neighbor, and we find out the neighbor's down. And then we do maybe show IP interface brief to see if the interface is up. So there's a whole sequence of steps, again, that you've done many, many times. So I think one of the great use cases for operational data is just automating that series of steps so that if you have a problem, first of all, you could just click a button or run a script and have it do all of those things automatically, or even better, detect the error condition, run some sequence of, I want to say commands, but really of operational data collection, and then give you back some kind of a report so your initial troubleshooting is already done. I've heard of a use case where one customer wants to, for every P1 incident they have, go through their troubleshooting steps and script it so that the next time that particular error condition comes up, they have an automated process for collecting that data. Again, it's stuff that you've done before. You don't need to do it every time you have a problem. So I think it makes our lives easier.
So in short, automate your troubleshooting.
That's, I think, a big use case, yeah.
And instead of wasting time connecting to all the boxes and collecting the data you need to start troubleshooting, automate that and just present all the data to the operator who is trying to figure out what's wrong.
Yeah, and if you get to into scripting, you know, the more you think about it, the more you can do. You could say, okay, maybe I want to add a show CDP neighbor and go to the next hop and start running the commands on that. I always tell people, particularly with Python scripting, and Python is, of course, the kind of the language of choice, you don't have to be an expert. Start small, a very small amount of knowledge of basic variables and control structures. You can start writing some pretty cool scripts with that. So.
Great idea. This is, by the way, the one area that most people don't even think about. It's, managing configurations, automating service deployment. Maybe some people think about auditing and remediation. Troubleshooting.
That.
Obviously, they don't do enough troubleshooting.
Well, they don't. And I mean, again, I think you really need structured data to make that efficient.
Well, first you need structured process.
Yes. That's right. You need structure, period.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anything else that you have on the boxes beyond NetConf and later RESTConf?
So right now in 16.3 on our catalyst switches, so we've been through this a little bit before. RESTConf is coming. Mm-hmm. It's not currently supported. I will put it that way. Other than NetConf, so in 16.3, that is the big programmability feature. We have a variety of day zero capabilities, which is also a good way to start with automation if you're nervous about scripting. So that would include things like plug and play, where, you know, you get the Switch out of the box and you need a certain image on the Switch, you need a certain configuration on it.
That's the thing where you send DHCP request and you get back a number of URLs as DHCP options, and then you pull down stuff.
Exactly. So most of our switches, well, they started out supporting our own protocol called Network Plug and Play. Mm-hmm. And you needed initially either Prime Infrastructure or APIC-EM as mm-hmm. the server for that. But now that is published. Actually, if you go on DevNet, you can see the Open Plug and Play protocol and how it works. But we also are expanding on our switches and some of our other devices. So, you know, some of our customers had Nexus and Catalyst, and Nexus mm-hmm. had this thing called Power On Auto Provision, which works slightly differently. So we're implementing ZTP, which is basically Power On Auto Provision on the Catalyst side as well. But as you described it, yeah, it's kind of like when you plug in the IP phone and it gets its DHCP options and then calls home. You do have to set up the DHCP server and put a couple options in there, and then you configure some sort of server with the images and configuration files, etc. And the newest version of APIC-EM 1.3, we have config templating too to make it easier to generate the configs for multiple devices.
Oh, so for people who don't want to learn Ansible.
Well, yes. Yeah. Now, it's a slightly different type of templating. I recommend people learn Ansible because it's a great tool. It's very powerful. It's an easy way to get your feet wet with programmability. And if you do CLI templating with Ansible, you're going to learn Jinja 2. Mm-hmm. And Jinja 2 is a very useful tool for doing netconf as well. So, yeah, if you don't want to do Ansible, that's another option. And I haven't really done image upgrades with Ansible. There is a way to do it.
There are people doing that.
Yeah, there's.
It's a bit scary, but yes, there are people doing that.
Yeah. So other features, like I said, did you want to talk more about Day Zero before I...
No, that's fine.
Okay. As I mentioned before, Onbox Python is mm-hmm. coming. Okay, I don't have an exact...
I think that was mentioned in the videos yesterday. And someone immediately sent a question, which version of Python?
Good question. It depends. So initially 2.7. Mm-hmm. 3.0 will be supported. It's going to depend on the capabilities of the box. I don't have the exact breakdown of which. I mean, I find that people still use 2.7 a lot because a lot of the libraries don't work yet with 3.0. Mm-hmm. But 3.0 will be supported depending on the platform.
And the whole thing, if I understood correctly, will run in a container.
That's right. Yeah, so we have a Linux container that runs on the device, and we're running Python in there. That's why we can do libraries like netconf on it as well. We can pip install those. The advantage of doing it on box is, of course, first of all, just distributing a script if you need to do that. You don't want to run it in a central location. But you can also do things like integrate it with EEM. So if there's some EEM triggered event, like, you know, you have an IP SLA ping going and you lose that, you can kick off a script on the box, which is harder to do with an off-box script.
So finally, we'll be able to use Python instead of Tickle.
Now, you didn't love CLI, but I'm sure you love Tickle.
Oh, yeah. Tickle is the assembly language.
Tickle, yeah, it has been around for a long time in iOS, and you can still do Tickle if you want. We're not removing it, as far as I know, but Python is a little bit better.
It's not hard to be better than Tickle, let's put it this way.
Yeah, Python, I mean, one of the power, a lot of times people ask me, like, why Python? Why not, you know, Ruby or Go, Perl? There are a lot of reasons. One of the big ones... One of the reasons I'm not a programmer is I did take programming in college, and I didn't like it very much. You spent a lot of time focusing on what was not the core problem of your software.
Yeah, you were focusing on the data structures,
yes,
getting them to work well, and traversing trees.
And things like, you know, I wrote programs on the Mac back before the Mac was mm-hmm. cool, and you had to make the scroll bars work. I mean, it took me forever to write the code to get scroll bars to work. The great thing about Python is it has, I almost call it like an app store. I mean, it has all of these libraries out there that do these things for you. So if you want to, I give this example in my breakout. When I was in IT, because I worked in IT for many years before I was here at Cisco in the business unit, everything was on spreadsheets. Like, we had so many spreadsheets. So if you want to read an Excel spreadsheet into a script, it's really easy. There's a library for that. It's simple. You can get all of your data out of an Excel spreadsheet. If you don't like YAML or it scares you or something, put it into a spreadsheet. You can generate PDF outputs. You can do graphs really easily. There's a library that works with IP addresses. So not just the syntax, but all of that makes it a lot better than Tickle as well. So it's a very powerful language.
I think you mentioned this already, but just in case you didn't, NetConf is shipping right now in 16.3, right?
16.3, that's correct.
Yeah, and well, NetConf was on the boxes for ages. In 16.3, you added all the new data models, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the Yang models came in 16.3. One thing I will mention, since we're talking about the Yang models, in 16.5, you will see a change to the Yang models. And just for clarity, this may be confusing. It's kind of like IPv4 and IPv6. And where did IPv5 go? Okay, we have, on the switching platforms, we have 16.3, no 16.4. The next release is going to be 16.5, just to be clear. So we skip 16.4.
16.4 is for CSR, right?
Yeah, it's not on the switches. In 16.5, and I think this is the same on the routers as well, the data model structure will change. And one of the reasons for this is, you know, we have the IETF models and the open config models, and then we have our Cisco model, or we call it a native model, or you can call it proprietary if you want. And just for the benefit of your listeners who may be confused by all the model types, you know, IETF, Open Config, and our models can all generally configure the same thing. It's just sort of the language or the grammar of it that's different. But with the IETF and Open Config models, they're generally going to have less features than our native model. Our native models will configure a lot of bells and whistles that you couldn't do with, say, Open Config. Or there may be features, proprietary features like, you know, EIGRP or something that they're just not going to model. So the reason I'm mentioning this was in 16.3, which was our first release with the models, the native model was really large. And if you're writing a script and you're just using NC client and you're sending just the raw XML, it wasn't that big of a deal. But if you used a tool that had to load in the entire model
and compile it and generate the dictionary and the API and all that stuff.
Exactly. It could take a really long time with a 16.3 model. So 16.5, what we decided to do is break the model up. So it's not one big model, and there are different XML, you know, namespaces for the different models. So you will see that change in 16.5. That's, I think, the biggest change that's on the horizon. So it's good to know about. You can still play with 16.3. And really, for most of the models, all you have to do is add a namespace to get it to work in 16.5.
And Python is coming in 16.5 or 16.6?
So at this point, I'm not 100% sure. I think on some platforms it will be in 16.5. I'm not sure on the switching platforms right now which that will be.
Okay, so we'll see when it ships.
Yeah.
And now that you mentioned programmability and programmers and all that stuff, the mandatory question I have to ask. Do we have to become programmers?
I always tell people, you don't... By the way, they're not programmers anymore, they're coders. This is the new language, did you know that? Oh no, they don't like to be called programmers. So I would say you don't have to become a coder, you can become a scripter.
What's the difference?
What's the difference? So I'll give you a simple example. Well, let me put it this way. I always tell people, you don't have to worry about necessarily thoroughly optimizing your code, you know, putting in all of the bells and whistles of Python, like error checking. You can start simple, right? So you can put together a script that's, you know, maybe not the most efficient way to do it. Maybe, you know, you don't know how to define a main function in Python and build a really nice structure or object-oriented Python program. But you know a few commands, you can start basically typing a script without all of that structure. And maybe it's not optimal. Maybe you don't know that you can do in Python, you know, for A comma B in C comma D and have a for loop that's combined. And you do two for loops. Okay, that's fine. You're not an expert coder. But if it works, great. So my point is, you don't have to learn Python to the level where you understand what a Python decorator does, which, honestly, they're confusing. But all you need to know is a few basic control structures and a few basic data structures, and you can start doing some pretty powerful things. You do have to learn a little bit about NetConf as well. We have tools to help with that as well. So the short answer is, I don't think you have to become a programmer or a coder, as we like to say.
Thank you.
Based on the conversation that went into the keynote today, it looks like Cisco is really trying to push APIC-EM as the solution to a lot of different problems.
Yeah.
in the enterprise space. Would you say that the side benefit of APKM being more broadly adopted is the ability for non-coder type folks to be able to introduce these new data model ideas through the REST APIs that are in APKM and gain a measure of control over their network, as opposed to just kind of, you know, maybe sitting down with one of Elon's blog posts about Ansible and hoping and praying that we don't wipe something out?
So, I mean, it's just a question of different approaches. And, you know, the problem with NetConf, I don't even want to say it's a problem, but I mean, it is a device-by-device type of protocol, right? And so if you put your devices into APKM, then you have those REST APIs available. You're dealing with kind of one point of contact. So that does make it a lot easier. You don't have the data models, you know, which you have with NetConf. But in some cases, you know, if there's any kind of abstraction introduced into APKM, the nice thing is you can deal at the abstraction layer and not worry about device-specific configuration. So it's not a question of right or wrong or which is better. It's a question of what you want to do, how much time you want to invest in learning how to use the tool. I think REST APIs, one of the big advantages is they're actually pretty easy to get started with.
Yeah, they're easy to consume.
Yeah. So, if you're new to scripting or coding, and they're usually pretty well documented. I mean, usually you can go to the web page of the system itself and click on like a button and see a list of the APIs, often with examples of how to call them. So that's kind of helpful.
Okay, so let's wrap it up. If people want to know more, where can they find you?
Well, where can they find me or where can they find more? Well, I'll give both.
Both.
So I do recommend going to Cisco DevNet. Okay, it's developer.cisco.com or just Google Cisco DevNet. We have a lot of learning labs on NetConf, REST APIs, and links to GitHub repositories where we put sample code. Myself, I do have a Twitter. I don't do much Twitter, I have to admit. I got the account and I'm a little behind. My Twitter is at CCIE14023. You can email me. I'll put my email out on the podcast. It's a little bit hard, so I'll do it slowly. JEMCLAUG@cisco.com. And you can replay that if you didn't catch it the first time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom, where can people find you when you are not running around and running the Tech Field Day events?
Well, if you want to follow me and some of my network rumblings, you can follow me on Twitter, Networking Nerd. Blog is networkingnerd.net. If you want to check out my Bruce Wayne job, you can head over to techfieldday.com and check out all of the great things that we recorded. A lot of the things we recorded here with Cisco at Cisco Live Europe. YouTube.com/techfieldday. We've got about 4 weeks worth of video up there. If you watched it from beginning to end, you could literally spend many, many, many hours doing nothing but listening to the dulcet tones of my voice.
Thank you both. And I'm Ivan Pepelniak. And if you want to read my grumpy blog posts, I was told today that I'm getting grumpier by the day. Go to blog.ipspace.net and explore.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.